If you're one of my students listening to this, you may be surprised to learn that almost nobody besides my students actually calls me Dr. Lewis. In fact, I regularly forget I even have a PhD. To almost everyone I know, I'm Angie. I have a deep and enduring affinity for cheese. I have adored Joey McIntyre of NKOTB fame since I was 9 years old and have somehow never outgrown it. I love exploring unfamiliar places and wandering new cities. My golden retriever answers to Bean, despite that not being her name. And the people closest to me know that there is almost nothing I enjoy more than laughing so hard I can barely breathe. But in the classroom, I'm Dr. Lewis, and that's intentional, which raises an interesting question. If authenticity matters, and spoiler alert, it does, why do we change how we show up in different environments? And is that okay? Are we adapting, assimilating, performing? Or are we demonstrating a skill that every effective intelligence professional, leader, and communicator eventually learns? How to meet people where they are without losing ourselves in the process. Welcome to the Unknown Knowns, where intuition meets tradecraft. I'm Dr. Angela Lewis, and this is a space for people who think for a living. Intelligence professionals, leaders, and decision makers navigating complexity, uncertainty, and imperfect information in a fast-paced world. Each week, we'll explore how intuition, bias, and judgment shape the way we make sense of complexity and how to get better at it. This week, we're talking about how we communicate in ways that build trust, credibility, and connection without losing ourselves in the process. We'll explore how context, professional identity, and organizational culture shape the way we communicate and why understanding your audience is one of the most important forms of intelligence tradecraft. There is this idea floating around professional culture that authenticity means showing up exactly the same way everywhere. The same tone, the same language, the same presentation, effectively the same version of yourself. But psychology suggests something a bit more nuanced. One of the most influential scholars to examine how people behave in different social settings was sociologist Irving Goffman. In The Presentation of Self in Everyday Life, Goffman argued that social interaction is inherently performative. Using a theatrical metaphor, he suggested that people present different versions of themselves depending on the audience and context. We all have front stage behaviors, the ways that we present ourselves in public or professional settings, and backstage behaviors that emerge in more private environments. For Goffman, this was not necessarily deception. Rather, it was a normal part of social life. People manage impressions, maintain social norms, and navigate expectations in ways that help interactions run smoothly. While Goffman's work remains enormously influential, it can sometimes leave the impression that adaptation is primarily about impression management, face saving, or avoiding embarrassment. Psychologist Carl Rogers offers a useful complement to Goffman's perspective. As one of the founders of humanistic psychology, Rogers was deeply interested in authenticity and personal growth. He argued that authenticity is not about behaving exactly the same way in every situation. Instead, it's about congruence, the alignment between our internal values, beliefs, and outward behavior. From a Rogersian perspective, authenticity does not require consistency across every context. A professor might be more formal in the classroom and more relaxed at a family barbecue, yet remain equally authentic in both settings. The key question is not whether our behavior changes, but whether those changes remain true to who we are. This idea becomes even more interesting when viewed through the work of sociologist George Herbert Mead, often considered one of the founders of symbolic interactionism. Mead argued that the self is fundamentally social. We do not develop our identities in isolation. Rather, our sense of self emerges through interaction with others and through our participation in social groups and relationships. In Mead's view, adapting our communication to different audiences is not evidence that we are putting on a mask. It is evidence that human identity itself is relational. Different relationships naturally call forth different aspects of who we are. Building on this idea, psychologist Hubert Hermans developed dialogical self theory. In it, Hermans argued that individuals possess multiple legitimate I positions that coexist with a broader coherent identity. We may simultaneously be parents, professionals, friends, mentors, researchers, athletes, artists, or countless other things. These are not competing selves or signs of inauthenticity. They are different voices within a larger conversation that constitutes our identity. Authenticity from this perspective is not about choosing a single real self. It's about maintaining coherence across the many authentic selves we inhabit throughout our lives. Psychologist Patricia Linville's work on self-complexity theory offers a related perspective. Linville found that people often possess multiple self-aspects that become more or less salient depending on context. Far from being a weakness, this complexity can be psychologically beneficial. Individuals with richer and more differentiated identities often demonstrate greater resilience because challenges in one area of life do not threaten their entire sense of self. A setback at work may be painful, but it does not define someone who also identifies as a parent, a friend, a volunteer, an athlete, or an artist. Self-complexity suggests that having multiple dimensions to our identity is not evidence of fragmentation, it's often a sign of psychological health. More recently, social psychologists such as Alex Haslam and colleagues have explored these ideas through the lens of social identity theory and identity leadership. Their research suggests that effective leaders do more than communicate information, they actively build shared identity with the groups they lead. Rather than asking, "How should I present myself?" effective leaders ask, "Who are we in this context? And how can I communicate in ways that resonate with this group's values, goals, and experiences?" From this perspective, adapting our communication is not about manipulation or performance. It's about connection. It's about understanding an audience well enough to speak in ways that create trust, belonging, and shared understanding. Taken together, these perspectives suggest a more nuanced view of authenticity than the simple idea of just be yourself. Goffman reminds us that context matters and that people naturally adapt their behavior across situations. Rogers emphasizes that authenticity is rooted in congruence rather than consistency. Mead shows us that identity itself develops through relationships. Hermans and Linville demonstrate that healthy individuals often possess multiple authentic self-aspects rather than a single fixed identity. Haslam reminds us that effective communication requires understanding and connecting with the identities of others. Viewed together, authenticity is not about showing up exactly the same way everywhere. It is about remaining grounded in a coherent sense of self while expressing different facets of that self in ways that foster trust, credibility, connection, and understanding across different contexts. That isn't dishonesty, that's social competence. But understanding context doesn't just change how we communicate, it changes how we think. And because I believe deeply in intellectual honesty, I should disclose something. Despite years briefing senior leaders, teaching graduate students, standing on stages, and generally functioning as a reasonably competent adult human, there exists one highly specific operating condition under which my cognitive performance degrades meaningfully. Joey McIntyre. And before anyone worries, no, not in a concerning way, in a deeply embarrassing, psychologically fascinating, and entirely self-aware way. Apparently, decades of professional development are no match for whatever neural pathways were established by 9-year-old Angie dancing to Hangin' Tough in my best friend's living room. I've met him on multiple occasions, and every time, externally, I am fully functional, even professional, certainly coherent enough to be fully capable of basic human interaction. I can carry on a complete, fully logical conversation with him. But that does not mean that I will remember a word that either of us said when it's all over, because internally, my prefrontal cortex is working so hard to just be cool that there is approximately 17% processing power available for anything else, which is humbling. And it reminds me of something psychologists have understood for a very long time. The cognitive resources being used to manage impressions, regulate emotions, or navigate uncertainty are resources that cannot be used elsewhere. We like to think that we are rational, consistent creatures who carry the same mind into every situation, but we aren't. Context changes cognition. Our brains are adaptive systems. For more than a century, psychologists have demonstrated that human performance changes depending on context. Researchers studying attention, working memory, cognitive load, emotional arousal, and social evaluation have repeatedly found that our thinking is shaped not just by who we are, but by the situations we find ourselves in. Stakes matter, identity matters, social expectations matter, emotional significance matters. Psychologist John Sweller's work on cognitive load theory reminds us that our cognitive resources are finite. Research on working memory similarly suggests that we operate with limited mental bandwidth. we are constantly allocating attention, regulating emotions, monitoring our surroundings, and processing information, all from the same finite pool of resources. Some environments require almost none of that effort. Others quietly consume enormous amounts of it. Have you ever noticed how sometimes you walk into a room and you immediately feel comfortable? Your thoughts flow easily, conversation feels natural. You aren't thinking about how you're coming across because you're simply present in the interaction. But other times, you become weirdly aware of your hands. You overthink a completely ordinary greeting. You mentally rehearse a sentence you've said 1,000 times before. You become acutely conscious of yourself in ways that would never occur to you in another environment. Psychologists sometimes refer to this as self-monitoring or social evaluation. Part of your attention shifts away from the task itself and toward managing the interaction. You're not just participating in the moment anymore, you're also observing yourself participating in the moment. And that observation comes at a cost. And I'll reiterate, the cognitive resources being used to manage those impressions and to regulate your emotions or navigate uncertainty are resources that cannot be used elsewhere. But none of that makes you inauthentic. It makes you human. Some contexts simply require more adaptation, cognitive effort, and self-regulation. Sometimes being yourself doesn't feel effortless at all. Sometimes it means working harder to remain calm, focused, professional, and composed while your brain and nervous system are busy responding to the significance of the situation. Context changes cognition, and cognition changes how we show up. Intelligence professionals likely understand this better than most. We spend entire careers studying bias, decision-making, framing, assumptions, and perhaps most importantly, uncertainty. But there is an important reminder hidden in all of this. We are not outside of human cognition. We are participants in it, and so are the people we serve. Richard Tuer spent decades helping intelligence professionals understand that the way people interpret information is shaped by cognitive processes, assumptions, mental models, and biases. Meanwhile, communication scholar Harold Lasswell framed communication around a deceptively simple question: who says what, through which channel, to whom, and with what effect? Embedded within those frameworks is a powerful idea. Audience and context matter, not just for how we frame information, but also because the people sitting across from us are navigating their own cognitive environments, their own pressures, incentives, assumptions, and limitations on their attention and time. The executive you're briefing may be carrying the weight of a $1 billion decision, and the analyst sitting next to you may be processing information through a completely different set of life experiences and expertise. The engineer, the lawyer, the policymaker, the operational leader, the professor, the student, each is bringing a different context to the conversation. And context influences what captures attention, what builds trust, what creates understanding, and ultimately, what drives action. And generally speaking, intelligence only creates value if it changes understanding or informs decisions, which means that the best analysis in the world can still fail if it doesn't land. It's one key reason why you generally don't brief senior executives exactly the same way you brief analysts. It simply may not land. And for that matter, if you walk into a deeply hierarchical organization and communicate exactly as you would with close colleagues or attempt to communicate with engineers exactly the same way you communicate with policy professionals, it may not land. Not because the information is wrong, but because communication is not simply about transmitting information, it's about creating understanding. Sometimes that means adjusting your language. Sometimes it means changing your framing. Sometimes it means leading with business impact rather than analytic nuance. Sometimes it means spending 5 minutes talking about a shared interest before discussing the issue at hand. And sometimes it means getting straight to the point because the person you're speaking with has 12 minutes before their next meeting and needs the headline first. Knowing your audience isn't manipulation, it's empathy, it's respect. It's recognizing that the people around us are navigating their own cognitive realities just as we are. And ultimately, it's one of the most important forms of intelligence tradecraft, which brings me back to Dr. Lewis. I don't use Dr. Lewis because I need hierarchy. Anyone who knows me personally knows that that cannot be further from who I am. I use it intentionally because many of my students are entering intelligence, security, government, and corporate environments where professional norms and organizational culture matter a great deal. A few years ago, I introduced a student to a former very senior intelligence official from the CIA. I happened to be on a first name basis with him, so throughout our conversation, I referred to him by his first name. A few minutes later, the student did the same. And it was a little jarring, not because the student was disrespectful and not because the former official was demanding deference. In fact, he handled it graciously. He simply corrected the student and continued the conversation. What he was really doing was teaching a lesson about context. The relationship I had with him had been built over years of professional interaction and mutual familiarity. The student and I did not occupy the same relationship to that individual, even though we were standing in the same room. The student wasn't wrong. He simply hadn't learned how context changes expectations. Organizational psychologist Edgar Schein spent decades studying culture and argued that organizations operate through shared assumptions, expectations, and norms. Some are visible, some are invisible. Some are written down, others are absorbed quietly over time. The most effective professionals learn to recognize those norms before they challenge them. They observe before they optimize. They learn before they disrupt. They understand the rules before deciding which ones should change. Or, put more simply, know the rules before you break them. Over time, something interesting happens. You develop a professional reputation. Not because you decided to create a personal brand, but because people learn what they can expect from you. They learn the quality of your work, how you think, how you approach uncertainty, and whether your judgment can be trusted. And eventually, that reputation becomes part of your professional identity. Not because you invented it, but because you earned it. And maybe that's what all of this comes down to. Authenticity isn't about figuring out how to be the same person in every room. Human beings aren't built that way. We don't move through the world independently of context. We respond to relationships, expectations, environments, and the people around us. The challenge isn't being the same everywhere. It's remaining grounded in who you are while recognizing that every audience, every organization, and every relationship brings its own context. Because authenticity and audience awareness aren't opposing ideas. They're complementary ones. The goal isn't to abandon who you are in order to connect with other people, nor is it to ignore context and insist on communicating exactly the same way in every situation. The goal is to understand yourself well enough to remain authentic while understanding your audience well enough to create trust, credibility, and connection. In other words, authenticity is less about consistency across every situation and more about congruence between who you are and how you show up. Sometimes it means being more formal. Sometimes it means being more relaxed. Sometimes it means spending a few minutes building rapport. Sometimes it means getting straight to the point because, again, the person sitting across from you has 6 minutes, 3 competing priorities, and absolutely no interest in hearing your methodological caveats before you to get to the answer. And none of that's manipulation. It's empathy, respect, communication, which is particularly important in intelligence because intelligence doesn't create value simply because analysis exists. It creates value when people understand it, when they trust it, and when they act on it. And that means understanding your audience will always matter, not because you're trying to influence people into agreeing with you, but because you're trying to help them to understand something that matters. So yes, I'm Angie. And yes, in the classroom, I am Dr. Lewis. Both are real, both are authentic. They're simply different expressions of the same person. Though, to be fair, only one of those versions is likely to enthusiastically discuss intelligence theory, cognitive bias, metacognition, and organizational systems for an unreasonable amount of time. Joey McIntyre has never been subjected to that version of me. And honestly, Joe, you're welcome. Because that's context changing cognition. And I think there's something wonderfully human about that. In intelligence, we spend enormous amounts of time trying to understand the world around us. This episode is really a reminder that understanding people, including ourselves, is part of the job too. Thanks for listening to The Unknown Knowns. If this episode made you think or rethink, share it with a colleague or friend who's ready to level up their tradecraft. Subscribe for more short, sharp conversations about the art and science of professional judgment. Until next time, stay curious, stay grounded, and keep turning intelligence into impact.